Hello and welcome back to episode 6 of the Post-Production Club podcast. My name is Luke Fritz.
And I am Gavin Buckland. So today we're talking with Melissa Kent. She's an editor who knows no bounds. She works on films ranging from drama to comedy, romance to sci-fi and thrillers. She collaborated with directors such as Ewan McGregor and Francis Ford Coppola. She's edited The Age of Adeline, American Pastoral, The Sisterhood of the Traveling Pants 2, and Virgin Suicides. But more recently, she edited Musica, a 2024 American coming-of-age romantic comedy film starring and directed by Rudy Mancuso. This is his feature film directorial debut. He also co-wrote the movie, composed the film's original soundtrack, was an executive producer. Also stars Camila Mendes from Riverdale fame. Musica had its world premiere at South by Southwest earlier this year and was released on Amazon Prime Video. So if you haven't seen it yet, definitely go check it out after listening to this in-depth conversation with Melissa. Melissa, welcome to the show. Thanks for coming on. Where are you calling in from?
I am in Los Angeles, California. And I know you haven't recorded a ton of episodes so far, but when I heard a few of them, I thought, I've got to support these people. And so I'm really excited to be here.
Oh, I love that. Thank you so much for giving up your time and coming on here. Have you lived in California your whole life?
Oh, no, definitely not. I moved a lot as a child, and I think that prepared me for a career in Hollywood. I was born in Virginia, and then we lived in D.C. I lived in New Jersey for many years, and kind of had the misfortune of moving to California on New Year's Eve in ninth grade. So I went from what was high school to junior high, had to kind of live through Mean Girls all over again, and then start high school. It was just a lot of upheaval, but I have been in California since that time. Went to school here, went to UCLA, and made my home and my career here.
I want to hear a little bit more about that journey, especially into the world of editorial. How did you start your career in film editing, and what led you to your work on the most recent film of Musica?
So the way I got started in editing is when I was studying theater at UCLA, I was also an intern at Entertainment Tonight. And they were great about exposing the interns to various aspects of production. So sometimes we visited set when they would go do interviews. We sat with the directors while they were recording the show. And once in a while, we sat with the editors. And that's the first time I saw what editors do. Now, of course, they were working with like a story producer for that segment, but I saw that they had a lot of power and a lot of input, one, by knowing the equipment and its capabilities of how to make it more interesting, and also just by nature of juxtaposition, which is everything we do, is one thing leads to another, and the order in which you see things tells the story. And they were such amazing contributors in the way stories were told. So I said, okay, I think I want this for my career. So back at UCLA, I took editing classes and I edited their student sitcom, student soap opera. Upon graduation, I just started as an apprentice. I graduated a couple months early. And so I took that time. I think I did work for free on one job just to get my foot in the door for Roger Corman, RIP. And that was on film. I did get to work on film just for a few years before everything became digital. And I'm glad I had that hands-on experience. And as for climbing the ranks as an editor, well, first of all, just my choice to want to do it. Being a motion picture editor involves a lot of skills that I'm rather good at, but not excellent enough to be a professional in that one thing. So with my theater background, I've studied, for example, acting and writing and lighting and costumes, and that all comes into play as far as being able to discern the better performances, the better frames. I also went to art school for a year and learned about, again, juxtaposition, design. And I've played music since I was 5 years old, and I was a dancer, not a pro, but I did manage to become a competitive swing dancer a year or two after Swingers came out, which, man, that was fun. But anyway, so all of this, I feel, comes into play with movie making. It's all helpful. And in my early career, I just, of course, I wanted to edit as soon as possible, but I kind of took a look around and realized if I could concentrate on becoming the best assistant editor I could for a few years, that would enable me to work on even bigger movies and see a wider variety of the way that editors do their jobs, and also at different budget points, how you accomplish things. Obviously, a Batman movie is going to have a lot more resources than, you know, a Roger Corman movie. So I still feel like I take that experience with me. And my personal choice was to work on the smaller movies that would give me more responsibility so that I could climb that ladder to becoming an editor. And I was always eager to jump in, cut a scene, or even for practice and get opinions from the editors I was working for. And, you know, ultimately I got my shot. And then, you know, you just put one foot in front of the other.
Are there any opportunities that stand out to you that were some of your most favorite or that you like really feel like you've learned the most?
The biggest break I ever got, an amazing opportunity, was to co-edit The Rainmaker for Francis Ford Coppola. This was one of Matt Damon's first movies, if not his first starring role. I had already worked as an additional editor on Gregory Nava's My Family, Mi Familia, which, by luck, Francis Ford Coppola was one of the producers. And he met me on that. And then about a year and a half later, when they needed a second editor to come onto The Rainmaker, he remembered me from that experience. So, of all the editors, I was like, why are they calling me? But then I didn't even really officially have an agent. He's like, don't question it. Just here, sign this paper with me and off you go. So, I mean, that was the experience of a lifetime to have my editing room just right off, you know, to the side of his main office and interact with him every day, hear his stories, hear his, you know, advice about filmmaking and be a part of such a cool movie. And that really started it all for me.
Wow. That is an incredible experience. Does anything in particular stand out during your time working with him?
One piece of advice Francis gave me that might be counterintuitive is he said, it's important to know when to quit. And we were talking about some life things, you know, maybe I was sharing my dating experiences or something at the time. But because I said to him with regard to something, I'm not a quitter. And he just said, Melissa, it's important in life. Sometimes you need to know when to quit. I guess it's equivalent to like, you need to know when to hold them and you need to know when to fold them. And so every so often, you know, I don't advocate for quitting jobs or quitting anything, but keeping your eyes open that when something truly is an experience that is not healthy or positive, to realize that you always do have that option.
That's really good.
Yeah.
So then how did you make the jump into and connection working on Musica?
Musica is one of my favorite movies that I've ever worked on. And I know it sounds nuts, but it's also kind of one of my favorite movies I've ever even watched. It just has so many elements to it that I absolutely enjoy in a movie. The way I got involved is I've always enjoyed working on movies that have a lot of music. And I haven't always been able to do such, but the last several years of my career, I'm trying to focus on that more and more. I don't want to be, my husband used to call me the best kept secret because that's just such a skill of mine is editing to music, but people didn't really know. So the last several years though, the stars have aligned where I've edited The Dirt, which is a biopic about Motley Crue on Netflix. I edited Mahalia about the legendary Mahalia Jackson. And even Tall Girl 2 had lots of singing and dancing, which really made me want to be a part of telling that story, directed by Emily Ting. So when it came to Musica, I had finished Tall Girl 2, it wasn't working, and I was looking at a list of upcoming films that were going to be made, and I saw the title. So of course I have to investigate immediately, what is this Musica? And then another stroke of luck is that the producers were Wonderland Sound and Vision, which is McGee's company. And I had just worked with them and producer Mary Viola and Stephen Bellow on Tall Girl 2. So now, you know, not only is it a story I'm interested in, but it's people I've worked with. And so much of Hollywood, it is that the people you know help you get work. And then when you show up, of course, you got to kill it. So as for Rudy Mancuso, I knew him from YouTube. He first got started on Vine telling his stories. And the unique thing about Rudy, co-wrote Musica. He stars, he's the composer, he's the executive producer, and it's based on his life. Now, until this time, Rudy had edited all his own material. And I've seen in the past where people are getting their shot to make a movie, they want to cut it, or sometimes maybe they want their like best friend from middle school to cut it or something. So I didn't know what the case would be, but I reached out to Wonderland, and Rudy realized that with just it being his first feature film and already wearing so many hats, that he needed to rely on an editor. And he wanted someone that he says, quote, speaks music. And I have this pretty strong musical background, and I even think probably editing is the best example of the way I work with music. So I totally loved the script. Again, like I said, it's based on his life, so he has a really strong point of view, and I just wanted to be a part of this unique, special, funny film. Had a job interview and luckily got the job.
Wow. It really feels like everything was leading up to this moment for you.
Well, I guess in retrospect, everything was. You never know. It does encapsulate so many things that I am good at. And I like to think that Rudy's talents and my own balanced each other in a really nice way.
I want to get into that. What was it like working with him as a first-time director?
I love working with first-time directors. There's something about them where they don't feel obligated to follow all the rules just because it's a, quote, industry standard of way of doing things. They bring a freshness, and I really love that. It helps you continue to question the way that we do things. That said, he's not truly a first-time director because he has directed so many of his YouTube videos, but I think they max out around 6 minutes. A lot of those videos, and as my mom even will say, if you're in a funk or you just need to cheer up, go to YouTube and watch Rudy Mancuso videos for 15 minutes. You know, it will brighten your day. So on those videos, he has so many with his puppets, with his music, clearly, with storytelling and song. So really the part that was new to him was the studio system, the professional feature film mix, and the preview process, taking audience feedback into consideration. On the one hand, having an extremely unique and strong and wonderful point of view about how the story should unfold, but then also just going through the experience of making sure everybody feels heard when producers or the studio or the audience has opinions, has issues. You know, we owe it to everyone to try it. The beauty about editing is that nothing we do is permanent until we lock it and we ship it. And unlike if you're on set and the question comes, do you want the character to wear a red shirt or a blue shirt? That director's going to make a decision and it's going to stick. In editing, that's where we play. That's where we try. And therefore, we can just keep going until we all agree, this is it.
The best films seem to have a director who have written the story. They have a clear vision of that final film in their head. You can tell that they can see it before it's even made. Rudy seems like a visionary dude. He wrote, directed, starred in, and composed the music, like you said, even executive produced. So it seems like he had a specific vision for the film, which in my experience, on the surface, that seems like a good thing because it'd be making your job as an editor a lot easier as there's less problems to solve and less problems to fix, you know, in the edit. I'm curious, though, if that leaves out the opportunity for an editor to have creative freedom on like a film like this. How much did Rudy lean on you for shaping the story? Did you have to solve narrative problems, or did he, as the writer, director, producer, own all of that?
I'm going to say both, because this movie is 100% Rudy, but it's also, on the one hand, I feel like this movie gave me the most creative freedom. I can only appreciate how interesting and funny and entertaining these dailies were every day. But yet, they send you a few hours of footage, and I'm going to turn it into a couple of minutes. So it does come down to my personal point of view and opinion of what is entertaining, what is funny, what's telling the story, and the way in which we should tell this story. Are we going to go from wide shots and get tighter? Are we going to start really tight and reveal? Those are all decisions made in editorial, and that's my job. So I applaud Rudy for making this personal story. Let's not forget he cast his own mother to play his mother, Maria, who steals the show. And he celebrates his own culture of the Brazilian Americans who live in the Ironbound neighborhood of Newark, New Jersey. So we've got a little bit of Portuguese, we've got puppets, we've got family, we've got the real locations where this real story happened. So Rudy's very grounded in how it unfolded, but we're not making a documentary about what happened to Rudy. We are making a feature film that we're hoping is going to entertain and delight and maybe educate people. We haven't yet talked about synesthesia, that it's a condition that Rudy Mancuso has and a lot of musicians have. Not a lot of musicians, but a lot of people who have it tend to be musicians, where your senses get a bit crossed. And a common type of synesthesia is where people hear a musical note and they perceive to see a color that goes with it. In Rudy's case, his brain takes the everyday sounds of the world, traffic, footsteps, conversations, silverware in a restaurant, anything, jackhammers, and turns it into rhythm in his mind. And our movie is one of the first, if not the first, that takes you inside the perception of a lead character who has synesthesia and lets you be in that world. So our everyday world erupts into rhythm and dance and movement exactly in the way that his brain organizes sounds, because he did indeed even write these rhythms before the performers did it. So in that way, it's showing me and everyone who watches this movie something we've never seen before. And Rudy was just super collaborative. I don't have synesthesia, so sometimes it was a discussion about how much should the music dominate, at which point does it become exhausting? How loud can these other sounds be while we're trying to focus on a conversation between him and Camila Mendes, for example? We want to be in that. So the fact that things are clicking and ticking here and there and getting louder and louder and louder, you know, we have to really ride that balance. And in that way, he was a true collaborator, and I really couldn't have wished for a better partner in crime.
Because of that film's rhythmic backbone, I'm curious to hear how much pre-planning went into the edit. Was every shot planned, or would you just get a bunch of like rhythmic-minded shots and you just got to shape it in the edit?
So here's the thing. Shots are planned and executed, but the edit is not. Now, he may have had a vision in his mind, but it's very responsive to what comes in. And there was a piece of advice that Judith Weston, who's an amazing coach of directors, and she's written a couple books. And one thing she says is just be careful that the director's vision, or if you're the director, if your vision doesn't blind you from what's in front of your eyes. So we need to deal with what we got. And the storyboards and the plan and the script, those are all have the best of intentions, but the movie is crafted from what we captured on the day. Yes. So we could talk about the scene in the park, which is a revelation. It's where Rudy, the character of Rudy, explains to Isabella, played by Camila Mendes, how he perceives the world. There are about 30 rhythm performers around the park who at the top of the scene are extras, you know, playing sports, basketball, jumping rope, on the seesaw, on a jog. And he shows her what it's like to experience the world with the synesthesia as one by one, as he points to different things, they become rhythmic. And in this scene, it's paired with orchestral instruments. So it grows and grows and grows to the symphony of sound. Now, Rudy is pointing here and there, and Camilla's looking where he tells her to look. And so that was the plan. So as the music's playing, and he's pointing here, well, yes, yeah, so sure, we want to see basketball. Then he's pointing here, we are going to see jump rope. Then he's pointing over there, we're going to see the people working, picking up trash. And so in that way, it was planned. Like, these sections will be on people painting graffiti, and this section will be on people playing soccer. But within that, the individual, we had probably four cameras going. And again, you just have to be responsive to how the actors performed it on the day and how the camera operator performed on the day and exactly what you got. So within that structure, I had total freedom of what we're going to see when. And in that particular scene, he did reach out, because that was day one and two of shooting. When he saw it, he said, okay, this is exactly how I envisioned it in my mind. And so he was very happy with that. And I think he just relaxed and we went about our business, you know?
That is so cool. I feel like a lot of the editors that I've met have a musical background. And so that's really cool that you got to bring that element into this, into a story that really, really called for it. Can you talk about your musical background specifically and like the influence that it played in shaping the narrative of the film?
On my first day of editing class at UCLA, my teacher said, to be a great editor, not only do you need to dance, but you need to dance alone. And he might have walked back that saying in later years, because I think some people who don't dance maybe felt a little like, wait, what? But because I dance, I always remember that moment of, yes, we gotta be responsive to the rhythm, and we can't rely on a partner necessarily. Even if we're alone in our cutting room, now, of course, we're with the footage, we're with the characters, we're with our assistants and the director, whoever else. But there's something inside of you that you have to be sensitive to rhythmically to help this movie be built in an interesting fashion. None of us want to watch a movie that feels like a march. We want it to feel like a dance. We want fast parts and slow parts, loud parts and quiet parts. And so I bring my experience with me, just have learning piano since the age of 5. Now I'm not good enough to be a pro. Don't ask me to play. But from learning piano, learning guitar, taking singing lessons for a few years, being a theater major, I think that just all informs how I feel rhythm in my body. And this is where AI cannot cut a movie, because we are each of us hired to bring our own individual perspective and rhythm. I remember one of my very early movies, it was called The Roman Spring of Mrs. Stone, and we were about done, and I thought, is this the best this could be? And then I said to myself, well, I don't know what's best, but I did my best. We all really like it, and they hired me for my individuality, and that's what's reflected here.
That's really cool.
Yeah,
I started playing piano when I was really young. And have since, you know, I think I was like 8th grade-ish, I started playing drums. And I just feel like that's influenced my editing style a ton. And it's so fun to get to feel like you're playing an instrument while editing.
You know, it's interesting you say that. I used to think about my Mac, my Avid keyboard, like I was playing piano. And I've had producers walk by. I remember on The Age of Adeline, one of our producers walked by and he said, wow, Melissa, the way you play that keyboard, it's like an instrument. Yes, and drumming too is great for coordination.
Yeah, yeah, that's for sure. I'm curious if there's any stories that come to mind about like a really challenging scene or a moment in the editing process of Musica where you just were like, I just don't know if this is working, and how you overcame that.
Couple things come to mind. As we were making this movie, it was so unique, it was so delightful, and it was so particular to Rudy. Sometimes I would wonder, like, are people gonna like it? Are they gonna be into it? You never know when you're making something so individual, and it's not just another sequel, another thing that's just like the last, that we know there's an audience. And the reception to this movie was so incredible, from our South by Southwest premiere, where it brought down the house, to the best reviews of any movie I've ever worked on. I think it's at 97%. it's almost unheard of. So the fact that Rudy stuck to his individuality to tell a story with his particular point of view, it's a risk. And kudos to Amazon Prime for financing this risk, for taking the risk and going on the journey with him. And then the response has been absolutely incredible. So I think that's a lesson in a way of do the thing that it might not appeal to everybody, but if we are all contributing and making individual stories, I just think the whole landscape of entertainment is going to be so much richer.
I agree.
One thing I do love about the opportunity to work on Musica is for once the edits got to be showy. They got to call attention to themselves, which is a rare thing. Usually we're trying to be invisible. But because of the nature of the rhythms, then the cuts to various inserts and picture and the broom, the iced tea, the salt and pepper, the microphone, the cash register can be obvious. And so that was really fun. The scenes in general were on the longer side, and it could be challenging to really home in, okay, what is this about? And make sure that the key thing that that scene is about is what's going to really shine in it. I know I'm speaking in generalities. One specific thing that was a challenge is that when I first read the script and I saw that the heart-to-heart between Rudy and his mother, Maria, would be performed in Portuguese, that was challenging. And I have edited movies that had other languages. For example, I mentioned My Family. The first 20 minutes are in Spanish, which that section stars Jennifer Lopez. I think it might have been her first feature film too. I've studied French, I've studied Spanish, I'm able to edit a scene in a foreign language, but I really wanted to understand the nuances of this scene. So when the dailies came in, I couldn't really tell sometimes if he was speaking to her as a director or if he was in the scene. So Rudy's sister Mariana and my assistant Kenzie Woodrow put subtitles on the whole scene, but I also started learning Portuguese myself. And so that was back in 2022 when we started this movie. So I'm a couple of years into it now. And that has really enriched my life. But every time I watched the movie, I was able to understand a bit more Portuguese. And it just became a thrill, you know, where something that was indecipherable became understandable.
That has got to be one of the like craziest things that I've ever heard an editor do for dedication to their craft is learning an entire another language. That is incredible.
Well, I love to learn, and it was really fun day by day to just throw a little bit more Portuguese at Rudy. Once he was sending me a piece of audio or something, and he said, "You know, I didn't edit it. Is that okay?" And I said, "Look, it's my pão e manteiga, which is it's my bread and butter." And he, you know, he'll get a laugh out of that.
What was the process of the music being so integrated into the storytelling as an editor for you?
This is what we're kind of calling a non-musical musical. People do not break into song, but it's more that, as the trailer says, this is about a man tortured by music, and his whole world surrounds him musically. Even if he's walking in the subway, he's seeing lyrics on the walls. His ex-girlfriend is talking to him. Musical notes are flying out of her mouth. Music is everything. So Rudy did compose all the rhythmic sections to which our dancers, which we called rhythm performers, performed. They had to rehearse them ahead of time. And if you look carefully, you'll see that the same performers show up, whether they are employees in the diner at the beginning, whether they are patrons in the fish market or people working in the fish market, whether they're playing sports in the park, whether they're on the bus. I mean, they swapped people in and out. So he wrote these rhythms ahead of time. They rehearsed. And I do want to say the music that they made by interacting with these everyday items was recorded on the day. So if someone's hitting a trash can lid, taking a book and making it go closed, stomping, you know, their feet on the bus, so many things, pouring iced tea, sweeping with a broom, those were all recorded live. And those tracks replaced the, you know, original rhythm that Rudy wrote in a clean and extremely dynamic way with the help of his executive music producer, Jamie Rise, who personally placed between 50 to 100 microphones for every dance sequence. I also had access to the original stereo tracks to which the performers had rehearsed, and I used that as my starting point. And then once we had the edit, Jamie would send me new tracks that were super pristine. And ultimately, he sent sometimes up to 100 tracks per scene to the final mix, where our mixers, Christopher Odd and Aaron Glascock, had the joy of having everything accessible. So if we cut to that microwave door closing, we are going to hear it a little bit louder. If we cut to, I don't know, if we cut to a pen tapping, we're going to hear it a little bit louder. And then we all, so, okay, so we have the live dance and performance, and talk about a challenge too. That was recorded all in the first week because we had the performers in town and they were ready to go. So the biggest scenes in this movie were all done up front. So yeah, we had to be up to the challenge of receiving all that. Then we have a bit of underscore, not a ton, that Rudy composed. It's absolutely gorgeous. And then we have things that we created musically just out of scene, out of sounds from the day. So I love where his mom says something very cutting, and he runs up the stairs and into his room and slams the door and claps his hands. The lights comes on. And so I'm taking those sounds. And of course, in real life, he ran up a whole flight of stairs, but we're doing like stomp, 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 slam, clap, light. And it just becomes a way to get from one scene to the next using everyday sounds, but making just a teeny little bit of a rhythmic measure or two. And that was super fun.
It kind of reminds me of that Broadway show Stomp. I think it was Broadway.
It certainly was. And I saw that actually before it was on Broadway, just by coincidence back in the day. But our choreographer for Musica is Marivaldo dos Santos. He's from Brazil, and he performed in Stomp for many years.
Wow.
He may have done some of their choreography as well. So we had the very best. He brought along loads of performers from Stomp. So they were very experienced in not just dance, but also in making music with everyday items.
That is so cool. I'm curious, switching gears a little bit, going less focused on the film and more so just on your editing career. I'm curious how you have navigated the dynamics of the editing room and film industry really at large, which has traditionally been male dominated.
Okay, well, there is a saying, if you want to find out what the field looks like, don't ask the rabbit. So I'm in it, right? On the one hand, I misunderstood. When I started my career straight out of college, I thought 50% of editors were women. It did start as almost entirely women, I think because they equated it to sewing, you know, gluing one piece of film to the next. And whether it was the men returning from World War II or just when the money got good is when the men started really taking over the career. So I thought it was 50-50. And then I was working on the Sisterhood of the Traveling Pants 2 in 2008. And one of the studies came out, I believe from UC San Diego, about how many women are working in each position in the top 250 feature films. And that's where I learned that it was only 17% female editors. I wasn't even aware. And it really has not changed. And that was, well, like 16 years ago. Wow. So I just do my thing. And sure, I've had opportunities where sometimes they want a female editor. There have been movies that I've cut where the producers realized, oh my gosh, every single person we've hired is a man and we are telling a woman's story. We should at least get a woman editor. And I show up to my job interview and I was like, go. So I'm going to speak for the whole gender. And so stuff like that's happened. So of course I'm invited into the rooms where they're interested in a woman editor. And there are some rooms I've never been invited into. And I kind of don't know the difference because I didn't find out about those. So, I mean, I just try to, I am who I am, and I do my best, and, you know, we get the jobs we get. So at a certain point, you look back and you go, well, there's my career. And in a good way, I'm really, really happy with all the projects I have been involved in. But you do have to have a certain confidence to state your piece and in your own skills.
Yeah. What advice would you give to editors looking to break into the industry at this level?
Things are really hard in Hollywood right now. I'm very hopeful that once these contracts get settled, work will pick up. Part of me is wondering is if the younger filmmakers and the recent college grads are going to have to do their own thing in a way, not just rely on the five studios to finance what they want to make, but work together amongst themselves in sort of an indie way, and like what you're doing with your company, your visual effects company, and your podcast, creating entertainment from the ground up. Now, I realize that's a heavy lift, and that's easy for me to say, like, oh, young people, that's what you should do. And I mean, and Rudy super duper lucked out the fact that Amazon did finance, you know, a movie about his life to tell his story. And I hope they do it again. On a very practical level, once things are back to quote normal, it's a great idea to work as a post-production assistant, a PA, in an editing room on a feature film or a TV series once. So, you know, I've had PAs with master's degrees in filmmaking, but it's important. It's an excellent way to see the entire process beginning to end. And that's quite valuable. And after you do it once, then, and so we're talking about the prep, if you're on at that point, the dailies, then once that's a whole grind. Every day we're receiving footage and I get the first cut together. Then we have the beautiful time of working with the director for 10 weeks where we experiment anything she or he wants to try. And then they see how music affects things, adding songs, how changing a song can really affect how a scene feels. We work with the producers, we work with the studio, the audiences, make any changes, and then finish it. And the finishing is another process between recording additional dialogue from the actors, recording the loop group for all the background actors. The official music gets composed, the songs get licensed, we have to swap out the songs, and then we have our final mix. So there's a wide variety of activities that is important for someone to see beginning to end before they go trying to make their own movie or just go be an editor. Then the next step is to qualify for the union, and you do that by working 100 days as an assistant editor, paid, on something that is distributed. So it cannot be your friend's short film that only goes on YouTube. It has to, you know, be a non-union show of some sort. You get your days, you get in the union, then you have way more opportunities for work. And I say kind of like what I did is you start as an assistant, you learn as you go. Look, if you can get through the first day, you can always read the manual of how to get through the second day and call your friends. There's so many ways to learn now between YouTube and Google and Avid and friends, and everyone's there to support you, and Facebook groups. And stay in touch with the people that you start out with, because time will go by. And 10 years after college, someone's going to be a studio executive. Someone's going to be an agent. Someone's going to be a composer. I did a film called An American Crime, and director Tommy O'Haver was working with the composer he went to college with and the writer he went to college with. So your time will come. And, you know, and if you need an editor, call me. I'm available. I'd love to help.
You can tell you're an editor because you just so succinctly walked through the most important steps and told that in such an incredibly clear and concise way that I have never heard anyone else do before. And so that's going to be so, so valuable to anyone listening on what a path can be. And I'm sure there's many, but to the one that you've walked and the one that many others have walked. It's very, very fascinating. So thank you for that.
You're welcome. Maybe I could also chime in about something. I've kept what I call the memo for years. This is something I started with director Sena Hamri when we did three movies together, Something New, Sisterhood of the Traveling Pants 2, and Just Right. And when we were editing, if something hadn't been shot exactly in the most helpful way, she would say, put it on the memo. And so I accumulated this list of advice for directors of way to avoid problems down the road. Now, also I had edited a DVD extra for the movie The Rainmaker, directed by Francis Coppola, where we watch him work with the actors. And it's called it's like HBO First Look, The Rainmaker. It's also called Francis Coppola Directs The Rainmaker. And it's a lot of great advice in there. And I put all of the advice from Francis and from my experience with Sena and just for things that happened along the way into this memo that I would distribute when I spoke at universities. And last summer, I broke it all down advice by advice, and I created sort of a editing tip of the day. Now, it's truly more like a directing tip of the day, but I did put it up on Threads if anyone wants to search at melissa.kent.1, day by day, with illustrations from movies I've worked on and how it worked out well, or maybe how it was more challenging because of the way things were shot.
That is amazing. Can you hit us with one right now from the memo?
Sure. One good piece of advice is to have your lead characters wear the same color clothes through the entire movie, if not the exact same outfit, because then you can change the order of the scenes all around. So in The Rainmaker, Matt Damon wears the same suit the whole movie, except for, I think, he might have even gone to a funeral in that suit. Mary Kay Place wears the same blue dress the whole movie. And it just gives you freedom to change the order of days. And if not the exact same suit, make it the color. And then the audience just won't notice you had to combine two scenes. So that's one. And the other, another one is be aware of loud jewelry. If a person is wearing, let's say, metal bangles, they're going to make noise and their hands are most of the time off camera. So if you're hearing these little clanking, and what's going on our dialogue tracks? And so the fix for that is just to tape them together.
This is so cool. You could package and sell this memo.
I thought maybe it could be a book, and I started really writing it, but it's more of a pamphlet.
I love
it. So it's just out there for all to read if you like.
All right. Well, everyone go check it out. The memo, directorial advice from an editor.
There you have it.
So what's been the best piece of advice you've gotten from a director?
One thing Francis Coppola used to say about directing is that directors are decision-making machines. So, for example, should the camera be high or low? The director needs to make that decision, and hopefully 80% of these decisions are good with regard to costumes, with regard to should the scene be day or night, all the things. But the most important thing is the director be decisive. And so I think that's an interesting thing for me to look for in directors that I want to work with. Are they decisive? Sometimes you might have a job interview and you might not hear for weeks or months. And then you hear, you're top of the list, but they're going to meet some more people. And then you say, okay, that person's not decisive. Maybe that's a red flag.
I mean, this has been awesome, Melissa. You've been one of the most prolific and insightful people we've talked to yet. And it's been an honor to have you on here. I'm curious how people can keep up with you and your work, and how we can continue to support you as an editor.
Thank you so much. I've really enjoyed talking to you. I do have a website, melissakent.com, and there's a press page. So, you know, when I directed a short film and I went to 36 festivals and was doing press at that time. And people do have a lot of the same questions. So that's a great resource, is just to click on some of those interviews, because people do ask me about how do you get started or things like that, and with editing. So there's a lot of information there, and I keep it up to date when I have something coming out. Threads is the only social that's public for me, but also it's the same name at Instagram at melissa.kent.1, and just reach out and request a follow, and we'll be in touch that way.
Cool. One other question that I had that we love to ask everyone that comes on here is, what are some of your favorite movies, and what are some movies that you think editors should watch in particular?
Oh, wow. Okay. My OG favorite movie is All That Jazz from 1978. Again, lots of singing and dancing and Bob Fosse. I mean, it's spectacular. And the editor, Alan Haim, is in the movie himself. He plays the editor of the movie they're making in the movie. So that's perfectly meta. I'm just going to go forward in time for some movies that I just really liked. I was thinking back about this. I really liked The Commitments and Evita. And so you can see a little common theme here, because I love a good music movie. Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind. I love that editing. And that was some inspiration for Musica. There's some scenes there where they sort of like exit one set and immediately they're in another set. And that was inspiration for us, although Rudy put his own twist on it and had the whole thing on a soundstage, literally walking between sets. Lately, I loved Rocket Man. I hope I can find the next Rocket Man. That was so innovative. Coda, fantastic. So beautiful. And there's a movie people really overlooked this past year called Flora and Son, I think it was called, Flora and Son, on Apple TV+. She is a single mom in Ireland and with a troubled son, and she buys him a guitar. He doesn't want any part of it, so she starts taking online guitar lessons from Joseph Gordon-Levitt. And it, in the end, music like really brings her family together. It's just so funny and so entertaining. Something that's extremely well edited, I always loved The Diving Bell and the Butterfly. I remember seeing that in the theater. So it's about it's a true story, and it's about a man who, I think it's called locked-in syndrome, where very quickly, like, your whole body just shuts down. And so he, like, through blinking, because he had been a writer for Elle magazine, he's able to write this story, like his autobiography, and then it's turned into a movie. And what they did in the sound mix, which is really risky, actually, in the theater, is anytime it was his own thoughts, he's like talking to himself in his mind, the sound was behind you. And anytime the world, the nurses, you know, are speaking, it's all in front of you. And I say it's risky only because in a theater across America, there's bound to be a theater where like the speakers are blown in the back. I guess we're in the theater less and less these days. But that's a beautiful, unique, interesting, heartbreaking, lovely movie. So any of those movies I just mentioned, I think will be a good time if you haven't already seen Musica.
Adding it to the list, adding all of those. Well, Melissa, thank you so much for coming on here. It was great to have you, and we're excited to see more films that you create.
Thank you, Gavin and Luke's. It was so nice to be here. I really want to support what you're building here with your podcast and YouTube channel. I've really enjoyed speaking with you, and thank you for the insightful questions.